Another question, David. You mentioned a core box.
Yes.
Can you say a couple of words about what that was?
Yeah, most people can get their minds around the pattern, how it works, how it comes out of the mould and leaves an impression, but they can't seem to get around core boxes. If you can imagine something like a pipe, a pattern for a pipe, the pattern itself would be made as a solid round pattern, no internals at all. The ends would be, on the ends of the pattern would be allowed projections known as core prints, or just prints we call them. These would be round diameter and they would be painted black, and they would be the same size as the bore of the pipe. Separately to this, a separate box would be made. Inside the box would be the shape of the inside of the pipe. So if you can imagine it, a half round. And of course, they were varied in size. Some small ones you could just put a handle about a foot square or so, something like that, or some of the tubes or whatever, or a cylinder, especially the cylinders, hydraulic cylinders at Fieldings, could be several feet long. So these core boxes would follow the size of the pattern, obviously. So some core boxes are so big you could actually climb inside. As an apprentice, on small side, of course, I did that, and plane with a hand plane, special round bottom hand planes, which looked rather like the old fashioned wooden carpenter's planes, but these had special round bottoms, very often made by the pattern makers themselves, and the curve on the bottom would be a separate piece, which was removable from the plane and clipped in place, so to fit whichever radius the core box was. The very small core boxes would be cut out with a gouge out of solid blocks of wood and in halves very frequently, and the two halves would be doled together. The core box then would be filled with a special sand, resin-based sand, which set very hard and would be baked in the foundry so it could be handled. So there you had, we should go back to our hypothetical piece of pipe. So there you had a tube of sand, which was handleable. It may have been on large size, they'd be reinforced with the steel bars or grids or whatever to make them handleable by crane. So they'd be craned into the mould, lowered into the mould, located on the black prints, which I mentioned earlier on. And so therefore, you'd still have the main cavity in the mould, and the core itself would run along the centre of it, and leave the cavity between the core and the sand mould would be the cavity for the metal to pour, take the metal up. I hope I've described that clearly enough. That was a very simple core, of course, as we were talking about a piece of straight pipe, but very often the cores were not that straight. They were curved, twisted, and where a large casting had ribs in it and whatever, the core box had to follow the shape of the ribs. And it did get quite complicated to explain without drawings or whatever. But
I think, thank you for that, David. I think a lot of people would marvel at the fact that it could be making a pattern could be so complex. But just going back a few moments to some photographs that you showed us, I think they were a couple of your colleagues.
Yes.
Would you like to say a couple of words about them?
The photographs, there's only two of my colleagues on there, unfortunately, taken during a holiday period when we were fooling about a bit. The foreman of the pattern shop was tough is the word, strict is another word, not very well liked is another word. Excellent at his job, brilliant man, lightning man, mind, he could work at a problem as he's walking towards it. But as I said, so there was not much extra work activity going on during work normal period. Anyway, these two people that we have, Lionel Longley, he sticks in my mind. He was the life and soul of the party. He died quite recently, actually, unfortunately, and he was about let's see, I was 18, he was 24, so that means he was 6 years older than me. At the time, he always was. As I say, there was Lionel, Longney, and there was George Holland, who was older still. He was, I think he was about 28 at the time, or 30, getting over 30. He was another good, well, they were all very good blokes, there's no doubt about it. I can't say any of them was incompetent or drifting along. George tended to stick with the smaller work. He worked in the annex to the main pattern shop. And I worked with him for a while, and he did more of the very smaller work that Fieldings did do. When I say small, I mean sort of a 2 or 3 foot square sort of thing, which would be large by most companies' standards. Bernard, the other man in the picture was Bernard Bolton. Yes, he was an ex-pattern maker. So I was told he was an ex-pattern maker, and he was in charge. He was foreman of the plate shop and welding shop next door, and he frequently popped into the pattern shop to do a bit of work for himself, which I'll come on to in a bit later on. Actually, we used to call them foreigners. I expect that the name's familiar with people, not immigrants. yeah, anyway, if I can go around the pattern shop now with the names, the first man I worked with, Dennis Brain, he was also fairly young. He was 26 at the time. I remember these dates because Lionel was 24, the youngest. Dennis Brain was 26, and George Holland was 28, all around about the same period. Anyway, Dennis, he was another good bloke. He tended to stick to the very big work. He was ribbed a little bit because he was a little bit rough and ready, but he got the job out. Bruce Fallander, the foreman, always urging men on. Everything was urgent. Come on, this is his wanted last week sort of thing, you know. So, I mean, Dennis used to cope with it, and he churned out. But like everybody else there, he was brilliant at trigonometry, geometry, mathematics. He could just do it, you know, because we needed. You couldn't square these patterns up, you see, by using the normal engineering tools, techniques like the squares or anything like that. We had to, it all had to be done with trigonometry. All angles had to be worked out and marked out in on a big radius and so on. You know, there was no sort of setting a gauge to it and working to a gauge. It all had to be done by trigonometry. Anyway, that's Dennis. Lionel worked next to Dennis. As I said, we just had Lionel. He tended to be good at most things, large and small work. Then next to him was senior apprentice. I think he was almost out of his time when I was there. Eddie. I think his name was Eddie Edwards, but I think we just called him Eddie. Then farther on was Dick Carter. He was elderly, actually, a very slightly built man, and he didn't do a lot of pattern making. He did a lot of template making for the plate shop next door because the flame cutting machinery always worked with templates, of course, in which the templates were made in the pattern shop, and Dick tended to do that sort of thing. He was a very versatile bloke. They all were, you know. And further on was his son, actually, Frank Carter. Again, another one. He could do anything you ask him to do. He later taught at the technical college, it's a joke about it, actually, because he actually taught mathematics. He had no qualification at all, but he actually taught mathematics in the pattern-making course, the City and Guilds pattern-making course. Anyway, further along from them was Tony Perver, who was a senior apprentice, much senior. Again, another capable man. And just around the corner from him was Ray Kilmister, who I would probably say he was the most brilliant. He stuck out. He got all the really difficult jobs to do. and he was good at it. You know, his work was always top quality. Not that the others were top quality, but you see, because of the size of the work and very often the patterns were only used once. You see, there was not much point in going to a high degree of quality of finish on it. As long as it was good and adequate for this job, the finish was good enough to pull out of the mould and it was the correct size and all the rest of it, that was adequate. But Ray's work was always that bit better. Now, that was the main powder shop. And there was an annex added to it where I worked later on with two others. I think his name was MacDonald Waugh, but we always called him Mac. He was older than all of us. He was born, I know this, he was born in 1900 because he was the same age as the date. Every time the date came up, you know, I said, I'm another year older. So he was born in 1900. I got on very well with him. He was, what might call it, square peg in a round hole. He could do his job and he was good at it, but he was what these days would be called an intellectual. He understood opera. He could quote Shakespeare, odd bits of Shakespeare, make jokes of it, and all the rest of it. Not to show off or anything, just to make jokes, you know. And for instance, when the directors came round, trooping round, inspecting, he'd start humming the Piers Chorus from Iolanthe. You know, I don't even know it. But so one of the lines is, "Bow down, ye lower middle classes." And whether the director ever twigged what he was doing, or I don't know, but I always amused me.